is the last Luther question for this retreat. So we see what the box has to ask.
Okay, here we go with question number one. What time does Noble Silence end on Saturday? I don't think it ever started, did it? The answer is surprise. Yeah. Actually, what time do we finish tomorrow? I don't know. 3:30 we finish. So Noble Silence finishes at 3:31. Is that a good idea? Yeah, okay. Keep it going as long as possible. Dear Ajahn, as I understand the five precepts, the first four are moral codes of conduct and the fifth precept is more a conventional rule. Following on from the discussion about the ambiguity of the drunkard being a stream winner or not, could there possibly be an argument that he was a streamer, given that stream winners are incapable of committing immoral acts but able to break conventional rules? Now that is an interesting question, but what happens is, why does anyone want to drink alcohol in the first place? Of course, we have like the conventions and the peer pressures, but like a stream winner, that thinks for themselves. They don't just follow peer pressures. And when I actually start to think of, you know, this drinking alcohol, it's just peer pressure, that's all. I remember, I must admit I was only 14, I should have been much older, drinking my first pint of beer, actually only half a pint, sneaking into a pub with my mates, because that's what boys did in those days, and thinking how sort of clever you were and how sort of mature you were and how wonderful you're going to have your first drink of beer. And it was disgusting. It was terrible tasting stuff. And that was actually quite a surprise, because all this stuff, I was risking a whole lot, actually, if I got caught, I'd be in big trouble doing this, but this is stuff which tasted rotten. But then later on, after a few months, you know, you got to like the taste, simply because you had to. It was a peer pressure which made you enjoy that. So sometimes you actually ask yourself, is wine really delicious? Is beer, alcohol, whiskey really delicious? Or is it what's called an acquired taste, because it's just what you have to do to fit into society? And fortunately, that we can be rebellious. We make our own society. And if you do have to fit into society and go to functions, you know, such as, what are they called? Dinners or... social gatherings, yeah, receptions and stuff. When you do that, you don't have to drink. You can actually just, like I did when you had to toast the Queen with your glass of wine. I lifted up my glass of orange juice. Here's to you, Your Majesty. With orange juice. Why not? Orange juice is just as well. So the thing is, you don't have to. And when you don't have to, you ask, well, why do I do it in the first place? Because alcohol costs money. And the only reason it does it is because it does loosen people's fear. It loosens them up. And it's only because they've got big egos. They need to loosen that fear in the first place. And it's a wonderful lifestyle not having to have alcohol and being free from all of that. So, you know, sometimes you see what happens when people have that alcohol. They really get into it and they start, you know, having lots of alcohol. They start with just small amounts and it starts to build up. And it does ruin your liver. I just read in the newspapers about a week or two ago that they, a long time ago, they said if you have alcohol, it actually clears up your cholesterol, you don't get heart problems. But apparently that's been completely disproved. They revisited the evidence, did the test again, and that's actually not true. There is no sort of benefits for cholesterol with alcohol. I think the original research was done by some brewery. So the point is that there is a reason behind it. It's not just conventional reality. There is some very good reason why people do not take alcohol. And if you've ever being a psychologist, a psychiatrist or doctor or whatever, you know that even small amounts of alcohol, they take away your awareness. You're not as sharp and as on the ball as you are without alcohol. And that's why that there's a certain amount which is so bad that the police can arrest you, because you aren't really in command of your vehicle. But even small amounts means you lose control. You know, it's not losing control, I don't mean like letting go. I mean that you can't really know what you're doing. And the whole point of Buddhism is that to be mindful, is to be alert, to be aware, to find out what the truth is. Not actually to dull everything out so you not really know what's going on. So actually it goes against a whole ethos of alertness, awareness, sharpness of mind. So that's why that it's not just a conventional reality, there's a real reason there why a person shouldn't be taking alcohol. So now with my story, just I thought, what the heck am I doing? Why do you have to do this? And my story was that sometimes you have to take it to excess before you realise just how stupid it was. And I went to what's supposed to be a very cultured college at university. This was Cambridge, it's supposed to be intelligent. But every year, they had in my college, they had the scholars' dinner, and I was a scholar at the college. And so that we started off with sherry in the gallery. And the gallery was one of the many buildings in this college, which was, you know, designed and built by Sir Christopher Wren. So it was a very beautiful building, very old, and this huge mahogany table. And this was like the big dinner of the year. So they had like the college staff were dressed all up as butlers. Now, real butlers with the coats and tails and everything, taking around this sherry, real good stuff, not the stuff you get from Woolworths or just from the cheap liquor stores, but, you know, really good stuff, in these beautiful crystal glasses on literally silver platters, solid silver. But these places are very wealthy. And as they were taking the sherry around, you know, this is how stupid I was. This is how I thought. Those butlers are going around in a clockwise direction. If I walk at the same speed in the opposite direction, then I will meet those butlers twice in a circuit rather than just once, thereby having twice as much sherry as my friends. And that's what I did, and I thought just how clever I was. So, after having many glasses of sherry already, then actually we went for the meal, which was a 9-course meal. And there we were sitting at these tables, you know, having this 9 courses is a lot of food. And with 9 courses, there was always sort of 9 different wines. You had to have a different wine with each course. And so the butlers, there was maybe one butler for about every 4 or 5 people, hovering behind you with the wine. And it was their rule, if your wine glass was less than half full, they wouldn't be philosophers, they would just fill it straight away. And so there wasn't so much so the food you were eating, but all the alcohol you're pouring down yourself. And after the 9th course, then we all left the dining hall to go to the old library, where there was big benches. And we had 3 glasses each, one for port, one for claret, and one for Madeira. And there were cigarettes and cigars and on the table with all sorts of fruit. And that wasn't enough, because all those things were filled up all the time. The killer was that this huge goblet, which was, you know, about this size, and it had jewels. It was a silver, not gold, a silver goblet with crusted with jewels. It was a cottage heirloom. It's probably worth now millions these days. No, literally. And it was filled. I forget which one it was. It didn't really matter by that time whether it was claret, Madeira, or port anyway. And you had to drain it. And afterwards say this toast in Latin, which most people couldn't do at all by this time. And it was just pure bacchanalia. And, you know, everybody, this was not just the students, this was the professors, and some of these were Nobel laureates. We had one Nobel laureate in there, the master, he was involved in it, just big time like anybody else. And all these supposed to be intelligent people were just getting drunk out of their skulls. And what happened to me, last part you don't remember at all, you don't know what went on. You wake up in your bed, you actually made it to your bed, which is amazing how that happens. And I must have had psychic powers in those days, I don't know. That was really miraculous. But when I woke up, not only did you have this incredibly bad hangover, you feel really awful and rotten, but there's a pile of vomit next to me. That's what I saw when I opened my eyes. I'd vomited up the contents of that 9-course meal. At the time, I didn't realize how dangerous that was. You choke on your vomit, I could have died. But it wasn't that what I was concerned about. I was just disgusted at myself. And I looked upon that, and I looked at how I felt. And everyone was going around saying, "Oh, what a wonderful night that was. Oh, that was really great. Oh, that was really amazing." I thought, what are you guys talking about? That was completely foolish. It was stupid. And the rest of the day, I can't do anything. I feel terrible. And when I looked at that afterwards, I thought, what a stupid, absolutely idiotic thing that is to do. And that was the last time I ever took any alcohol. When you actually look at it, it's ridiculous. Why are you drinking this stuff, this alcohol, and sometimes getting drunk, endangering your life? You know, there was a car crash just outside there a few days ago. Someone died, apparently, run over by a car. And first thing the police will do will actually go and check your alcohol level, if you're the driver, or even if you're the person walking across the road, not taking notice. People die because of alcohol. What do you do it for? If you want something to drink, have a glass of water or an orange juice or a cup of tea or anything. It's much more healthy than alcohol. So why is it we've got this big thing about alcohol? It doesn't make no sense at all. And after a while, when you know how to, look at me, look, I've been on this retreat for, like, it entertain you every evening, you have a good laugh, you have great fun, and you don't have any alcohol. It's like a party every evening without alcohol. And actually, you don't need alcohol to have a good time. It's amazing to have, like, non-alcoholic parties, and you have enjoy yourself much more than the alcoholic ones. So that's why. It was not really conventional reality. There's a reason behind it. And that's why we stop. All my jokes about alcohol, you all know those. You know, the ones of you who don't know, the one which is really kills people, you know, when they hear this, especially the Asians, because they're so scared of ghosts, is when I talk about the bottle ghost. You all know the bottle ghost one, don't you? You don't? My goodness. You should know this because, you know, there are ghosts in Australia, all over the world. And some of those ghosts they are dangerous. You've got to really look out for them. Have you ever seen a possession by a ghost? I have. Actually, you have, but maybe you haven't recognized it. The bottle ghost often possesses people. It's the most dangerous ghost in the whole world, and it's actually killed many people every day. It's the most dangerous ghost in the whole world, and it's real. This is not imaginary. This is not just something in Hollywood. This is real life. So I've been going around the world warning people about the bottle ghost. And of course, you know that as soon as you open up the bottle of spirits, that's why it's called spirits, the ghost goes inside of you and it possesses you and makes you do crazy things. Have you ever seen anyone possessed by the bottle ghost? They're drunk, they're out of their mind. And that's why the bottle ghost has actually killed many people. So if anyone, especially in Asia, wants to be afraid of a real ghost, the bottle ghost, don't open that bottle of whiskey or that bottle of beer, otherwise a bottle ghost is liable to get you, possess you. Anyway, so that's why we don't have alcohol. It's more fun without it. Dear Ajahn, is there any questions about that? And for those of you, this is practical but good fun too. Those of you who get into trouble, you go to parties, you go to receptions, it's part of your business, and people say, come on, have a glass of wine or have a glass of whiskey. Because one of my disciples said, no, it was very difficult, in Australia especially, to say, no, I can't drink because I'm a Buddhist. Because in many places, they're very unreligious. And they say, no, if they do know anything about Buddhists, they say, oh, we know about Buddhists, it's all about letting go. Come on, let go, have a glass of whiskey. And so this guy, he said he was a Buddhist, no one would believe him. Come on, don't be sort of attached, have a glass of whiskey. And he found it very difficult. But what really worked for him was when he told people, no, I cannot drink alcohol, it's doctor's orders. They said, oh, okay, fine, okay. I don't argue with you if it's doctor's orders. But then, if you haven't heard the story before, I said, aren't you keeping one precept by breaking another precept by lying? Your doctor never told you not to drink alcohol. And he said, oh, yes, he did, Ajahn Brahm, because the Buddha was the doctor. Because he compared himself to being a doctor. So it's actually Dr. Buddha's orders. So you can always say it's the doctor's orders, and they believe you. Anyway, any questions about that? Cooking wine is fine because that evaporates. As long as you put it on before it goes in the oven, not afterwards. Or if you put brandy on it, light it. It looks amazing. It's very impressive. Like, boom. But then that gets rid of all the alcohol. Dear Ajahn, do you think there are jobs that are more or less conducive to practicing the Dharma and peaceful mind states? Yes. Being a monk. That's a really conducive job. Don't you think that's the right answer? Do you think there are jobs that are more or less conducive to practicing the Dharma and peaceful mind states? For example, I'm doing a PhD, which is very cerebral and forces me to think all the time. Would a job where one works with their hands or spends less time in their head make it easier to be mindful, etc.? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Bigger sadhus every time. It's not really, because it's only those jobs where you're hurting other beings. Or like you're selling arms or selling whiskey or prostitution or that sort of trade where it's really yucky and you don't feel good about yourself afterwards. Because you haven't really helped anyone, you've just created just more problems in the world. So that's what we call like wrong livelihood. They say like basically like they used to say like fishermen or sort of butchers, or they even used to say like prison warders. But these days the prison warders are not the same as prison warders in the Buddha's day, where they would actually punish you and they would execute you. Maybe a prison warder in Guantanamo Bay would qualify as wrong livelihood. But in most prisons, the prison warders are usually pretty okay. That's not such bad livelihood. Right, which is very cerebral. Sometimes, if it's very cerebral, it can be even conducive to practicing, because you can actually train your mind, and the best way to be cerebral is to rest your mind from time to time. And that way you are actually more productive. So yeah, you can actually think from time to time, but if you think too much, your thinking is never directed. It just goes all over the place. So part of the job with meditation is, if you are going to think, you can think efficiently. Think in a straight line instead of going all over the place. And that's one of the things you notice when you develop meditation. As a problem solver or as a creative thinker, you are much more efficient, much more productive. If you've got something to think about, instead of just worrying about it, you say, well, what's going on? It becomes like just A, B, C, D, just one after the other. You're efficient and organized. If you have a look actually how you think, it's mostly very disorganized. You think of one problem, then you go off on a tangent to some other problem, and then another problem, and then you come back to the first problem, and you get all confused, you don't know where you are. But when you get some peace in the mind, you actually go straight line. Whoosh. And you get solutions very easily. So that's why when people meditate, they become great managers of their mind. They know just how to stop and then how to think. So it becomes efficient thinking when you meditate. So if you really have to think a lot, then you really need meditation. So you think efficiently. And this also is mentioned to someone with creativity as well. To creativity, you've got to sort of go against your habitual ideas to see something new, something original. And to be able to do that, the more still you get, just the more these new ways, these new insights. That's why I think that when you have a very still mind, that's when you get eccentric, because you can do things which other people have never done before. Now the sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. No other monk has done that before, because you're eccentric, and that all comes from the creativity of the still mind. There you go. So I think it's, you know, the livelihood of being cerebral is fine as long as you make use of that. Most of the livelihoods, it's not the livelihood, but how you make use of it. As many years ago, there was this guy who was a bus driver in Perth, and he just was really complaining, is this really right livelihood? I'm not really helping anybody. It's just a bus driver, the most boring possible job you could do. So, no, it's not. All these people coming onto your bus, smile at them, be kind to them. You're meeting so many people every day, and just your attitude can mean so much to them. So it's not just driving your bus, just add that bit extra to it. And he appreciated that and became a much happier bus driver. So it's if you are cerebral, then put a bit of fun into it as well. If you are writing a thesis, add a few jokes. Well, someone's got to read it. And your poor sort of, you know, supervisor, whoever's got to read that, oh my goodness, you get a big batch of cerebral stuff, oh my goodness. And you put a joke in there, oh, you know, this person's actually thinking about me, and they'll give you a higher mark. Ha ha ha. Uh-oh, I'm in trouble here. I am so disappointed that I couldn't get breakfast in bed from Ajahn. Because I said, anyone who gets enlightened or something, jhana, I've been to breakfast in bed. I didn't say what breakfast it would be. But anyway, what do you mean, yet there's still another day to go? There is another, I worked it out just earlier, like 54,000 seconds left. And any one of those seconds, it's possible to become enlightened. So you've got 50,000 chances yet to get enlightened or get jhanas. So it's heaps of chances, many, many seconds left. I call them second chances. I thought you might like some feedback on this morning's meditation. You did? No, I think you're wrong. I didn't want any feedback. No, I would. I chose the gift of silence, the gift wrapped for myself. I duly wrapped a big green slab of silence, as was the thing I needed most, to shut up all the fantasies, daydreams and other chatter that was messing up the meditation. When I opened it, however, I found a white board duster and some spray. Behind on long white boards was all the things I had been thinking about, like movies. Once I had used the spray and duster to clean the whiteboards, I had the most amazing silent meditation. Excellent. So that's actually someone who's been innovative. So they put in big green slab of silence, and they've got this board duster, a whiteboard duster, like, you know, the whiteboards, we haven't got them here, you've seen them somewhere, and the spray and the duster to dust and spray their mind and make it clean. And so they had a nice imaginary operation of cleaning their minds, and they had the most amazing silent meditation. So it's marvellous. What you can do is actually get a bigger box and put a vacuum cleaner in there. Open it. Put it up here, up your nose. And suck out all the mess. But be innovative. Makes a lot of sense to me. Dear Ajahn, in this morning's talk you mentioned about that a nun at the time of the Buddha, whom after 7 years of meditation did not even get a peaceful mind state, and she was about to commit suicide, she became fully enlightened. This does not sound consistent with the idea that you need jhana for enlightenment to happen. Please comment. Actually, it didn't say she got enlightened and her mind was released then. That would have been a time when the mind actually went into a jhana, or went into a very deep peaceful state. As you do when you let go, it's when she probably saw the nimitta, and that was the whole process for enlightenment happened from that time. So he didn't get enlightened at that time, at that moment. Same as Ananda, he'd been doing the jhanas before, but when he actually touched the pillow, that was when the whole thing came together. Phew, just got out of that one. That's why whenever you talk so much, people are always listening and looking for inconsistencies. Say, aha, I've caught him this time. The Ajahn, in relation to the other night's statement you made about how monks would eventually disrobe if they do not get jhanas, isn't it suggesting that the whole underlying theme of that statement is worldly happiness is greater than the happiness of enunciation? If I recall correctly, I remember reading in one of the Nikayas where the Buddha quoted saying, "The happiness of renunciation is greater than the happiness of non-renunciation. Please explain the disparity in views." See, someone's caught me out again. "By making such statements, are you putting extra pressure on results rather than causes, especially for aspiring monks? And probably even deterring aspiring lay people to go forth due to the risk of not attaining jhanas and eventually disrobing." Okay, like what renunciation is, they say, when the Buddha said the happiness of renunciation is greater than all other happinesses. And you know what the happiness of renunciation is? In Pali, it's called Nekama Sukha. It literally means renunciation happiness. The word for renunciation in Pali is Nekama. And anyone who knows the suttas knows that Nekama Sukha is another word for jhana. The Buddha said there's four descriptions he called for the happiness of jhana. Nekama Sukha was one of them. The happiness of renunciation. They also have Upasama Sukha. Upasama means just really soft and even and quiet. It literally means the happiness of peace. Was it Nekama Sukha, Upasama Sukha? What's the other one? I know Sambodhi. Yeah, I know that one, but I'll give it to last. Oh, yeah, Paviveka Sukha, yes. Paviveka means real seclusion. So you're just completely away from all the five senses in the world, away from everything. You're really far from the madding sounds, sights, smells, tastes, and physical touch. And the last one, which I was leaving to the last, was my favorite, the Sambodhi Sukha, enlightenment happiness. So when in the suttas, the Buddha says the happiness of renunciation, he was actually meaning jhanas. That's the happiness of the renunciant life. That's the happiness of a monk. Is the jhanas, and their beauty is their precepts. This is in the Digha Nikaya. I forget what the other ones were, but I always remember those ones. So in the world, and their wealth, I think their wealth is their metta. And ornaments, yeah, the jewelry is their psychic powers. So that's actually, they're looking, comparing like the monk. You know, the people in those days were really into jewelry, even the blokes. And, you know, always everyone is into beauty. The beauty for the monk is their precepts and their ornaments, you know, the stuff which, they're only extras, they're not really necessary, but just to show off your psychic powers. So that's really fascinating. But so it says here, the whole underlying theme is the statement that worldly happiness is not greater than the happiness of renunciation. No, the happiness of renunciation is always greater than worldly happiness, but you've got to get that happiness of renunciation first of all. So when you actually just superficially renounce the world to become a monk or a nun, so that, you know, you haven't got anything else yet, you're going on faith first of all. And usually that faith can actually last for 2 or 3, 4 years, the inspiration of like the whole idea of monastic life. And you really try your very best. But if you don't really get those jhanas, at least get close to the jhanas as a monk or a nun. Sometimes the mind quite naturally will seek for happiness wherever it can find it. And it will usually sometimes seek for the happiness. Well, what's the point of being a monk? I can still have no relationships, and sometimes meaningful relationships. And I go for the lower happiness if we can't get the higher happiness. And I've seen that just throughout my monastic life a lot, many, very often. But it's not always the case, because sometimes the monks and the nuns, they can find some other sort of fulfilling reason to live their life as a monk. But if you know, you're not monks and nuns yourself, but imagine what it's like being a monk and nun. What are you doing? What are you doing this for? What are you getting out of this life? Because you can leave any time you want. So if you've got this inner sort of power, peace, you know, from meditation, then you're set. You're having a wonderful time. If you haven't, and sometimes you see, well, some lay people get these jhanas, and I'm not getting them. And maybe if I can leave, that I can maybe just, you know, who knows, I may be able to get the jhanas as a lay person, also see Star Wars as well, so I can get everything. So there is actually a pull on monks. There has to be some natural happiness they get as a monk or as a nun. And the thing is that our life is actually run by the search for happiness and fulfillment. And whatever you do is for the sake of finding some happiness, some fulfillment. And now life as a monk, sure, you're sort of living a simple life. But if you go back to your heart and nothing's really going on in your meditation, not getting any joy and happiness, you get very bored. You end up sort of spending time with the other monks talking about all sorts of rubbish or sort of wasting time. And sometimes, you know, that you can get involved in projects and doing things. It's a waste of time because you're doing something, you're building something. It might be good for the monastery, making good karma, but it's just missing the heart of the monastic life. One of my favorite stories of this monk, who he was living in a small vihara. Those of you who've been to India, you can see the way they had those viharas, like little clusters of little rooms around a main courtyard. And he was living in such a vihara, and he was such a diligent monk, he'd be sweeping the place all day and keeping it spotless. And sometimes people think, oh, what a diligent monk that was. But then they had one of these other great disciples of the Buddha, Mahakachana, saw him and said, look, you didn't become a monk to be a cleaner. It's wonderful you're keeping the place spotless, but don't keep it spotless by sweeping it all day. Maybe do an hour in the morning, maybe an hour or two in the evening, and the rest of the day do some meditation. Here I'll teach you how to meditate. And so he taught this monk how to meditate, and after a short while the monk got the jhanas and became fully enlightened. And from that time on, that vihara was never as clean as it used to be. But we had one more arahat in the world. And what a wonderful thing that was. So the point was actually saying what the purpose of real monastic life is, not to actually to be caretakers of monasteries, so lay people can go there and think, oh, what an inspiring monastery this is. It is so clean. The purpose of the monastic life is to gain those jhanas, become enlightened yourself. And that's made very, very clear. And if you can't do it, maybe not this life, maybe the next lifetime. So it's not easy being a monk or a nun. But you know, with a bit, you know, you can support the monks and nuns, give them food, but that's not enough. You know, they need some inner inspiration. Bhavana means cultivation, like samadhi means the result of cultivation.
Yeah, like you, whatever you do, I mean, like, although you have a goal and a jhana, but if the cultivation of the goodness, not the time span, you know, like you have a goal for that. So I'm thinking that, like, for example, you do things here.
If the cultivation is getting somewhere, basically the, you know, just the same as anyone coming to this retreat, if you haven't got anything at all in this retreat, you go home and you're even more stressed out, more confused than when you began, you're not going to come again. If you've got something, if you're getting somewhere, then you'll come again. So it's the same with the monks. They'll be meditating and meditating and meditating. If they're getting closer and closer and closer, yeah, they're going to carry on. But after a few years, if they haven't really got that close, they think maybe it might be better just to disrobe and just enjoy the lay life. If I said that someone here got jhana, how many people would be happy? They'd be thinking, why them, not me? So you have a point there. But actually, this really came up just, you know, seeing some sort of monks who really make it in the monastic world, just from experience, and also seeing in the suttas, seeing this is the Ananda is saying that this is the consolation of monastic life, jhana. And yet, this is his words. If it's not that jhana, there's no real consolation. So it's an incredible, powerful saying which was there, and I said, well, there's a lot of sense in that. And I've mentioned this to the monks. This is one of the reasons why I encourage retreats and I push these jhanas and I keep encouraging them and keep on teaching them and saying how they're done, what happens, giving as much input into there so that actually the monks do aspire towards it. If you don't aspire towards it, you don't get them. When you do aspire towards them, the whole monastic life becomes very clear. And not only that, we're getting some really powerful, good monks and nuns for the future to teach. So I'm really pushing this to the hilt. Because when you push it, when you market it, you're liable to get some results.
Hey, Jen, how do these old guys, you know, if they go into the monastery late in life,
yeah,
they give up all their wealth and they don't make it, what happens 4 years later when they've got to try and get
that's this? Big trouble. They have to give up everything. Well, what we usually do in our monastic tradition is it is a big trouble for them because, you know, they a lot of time, especially elderly people, they go forth and they're very proud by that age. And I'm giving up everything. I'm going to be a monk forever and ever and ever. And then when they sort of describe it, it's very sort of embarrassing for them. So they didn't give it up forever. So it is very difficult. But what we do with young monks here, especially more like middle-aged monks, monks who have got some wealth, I tell them that when they ordain, they're not allowed to use that money, but they put it aside, they give it to, put it in a bank account or whatever, don't use it at all. So, for example, my lay name before I was a monk was Peter Betts. So if I ordained, now I become Bama Wangso, any money I say, put it aside, that belongs to Peter Betts, it doesn't belong to Bama Wangso. And keep it there for maybe 3 or 4 years. And maybe after 3 or 4 years, you shouldn't really know whether you're really going to stay a long time or not. If you are going to stay a long time, you can actually give that stuff away. But if you do disrobe, then you change from being Bama Wangso and you Peter Betts again, then you can make use of that money, which you put aside. And I've done that because that sometimes about 3 or 4 years is usually one of the turning points in monastic life. And now it means that if they do make a wrong decision after 3 or 4 years, they've got their worldly wealth to go back to. Otherwise it's just disgusting, it's terrible, they've got nothing left and they have to start all over again. If they're young it doesn't matter, but if they're middle aged or old, it gets very, very difficult to know what to do with them. And you know, we can't get a collection for them because sometimes it's not merit making giving money to sort of a monk who's just left. So it's very difficult sometimes. Yeah. Yeah.
We reveal
something which is there anyway. Yeah, indeed, yeah. Like, so jhanas are always there, like covered up by all these other thinking and thoughts and striving and stuff. When you get out of the way, they reveal themselves. So sometimes you call it realizing jhanas.
And if you haven't got it, it's simply that you haven't reached that stage.
You haven't sort of emptied out enough. You're still covered up with all your doing and stuff. So there's always a chance there, but this is just like a rule of thumb. This is not sort of theories. This is actually, you know, my experience of being a monk for a long time. That's why I'm encouraging it. It's great to encourage it. Then get some monks who you're really proud of. Yeah.
Doesn't the same thing happen in the lay life, that you spend years and years and years doing nothing and getting nowhere, and then, like, many people just get depressed, to lay people and kill themselves or whatever, or just, like... just do nothing, you know, just be depressed and
yeah,
these depressed old guys.
Yeah.
It seems like the same.
Yeah, but you don't want depressed old guys in a monastery because, you know, you're supposed to be inspired by those. You don't go to people's houses to get inspired and just listen to Dhamma talks from depressed old people. But you do go there to monasteries to find inspiration and meaning for life. And, you know, you do expect sort of your monks and nuns actually to be, you know, happy and inspiring. And most of them are. But if they're not, they usually end up just leaving anyway.
Yeah. I think the point I was getting is if you don't attain any samadhi as a layperson, it's like the same as being a monk in no samadhi.
Well, in one sense, but usually what happens with monks is they get samadhi, they become a bit shameless monks, and they do stupid things. They look for the happiness elsewhere. That's where they start getting TVs, can't get samadhi, but at least I can concentrate when I'm watching the soccer. That's what happens. You got any? Yeah. Ah, no. Because the emptiness is always there. But it's just another way of looking at it. Sometimes, remember, I've given this simile of the 1,000-petal lotus. And what meditation is, you've got this lotus, and your mindfulness or stillness is actually the heat which opens up the petals of the lotus. And the next petal of the lotus is within the one year, which is open now. So the ordinary lotus, when it's all closed up, just this weather-worn, dirty, old, scruffy lotus leaf. And it's not all that fragrant. It's very coarse because it has to take the weather. That's just the ordinary mind. But once you start meditating, it opens out, and you see the petal inside. And that's a bit more delicate and fragrant and beautiful. But that's, you haven't got to jhanas yet. You've just got to say present moment awareness. And then you say present moment awareness, after a while that opens out into the beautiful silence. And that's even a more beautiful petal. And after a while, silence opens out to see the breath. And after a while, the breath, it opens out, it's actually a beautiful breath. It happens naturally, it just opens. And there you are, this beautiful breath. And as you go deeper into the lotus, it gets even more beautiful. In the middle of the beautiful breath, wow, you've got this incredible nimitta. That's an amazing, beautiful coloured petal right inside. Inside that nimitta, then that opens out. Wow, that's your first jhana. So the first jhana, that layer of petals, is inside the lotus all the time. It just needs to be opened out as we go in, inside. So that's what I meant. But as you go in the jhanas, you go into the four jhanas, then you go into the immaterial states. And when you get to sort of the, like the petal of the neither perception or non-perception, now you're getting a very, very subtle petal. It's gossamer thin, and it's the most beautiful, refined thing you've ever seen. And right inside of that is what we call the jewel in the heart of the lotus. In the Vajrayana tradition, they say, Om Mani Padme Hum, which literally means, I worship the jewel in the heart of the lotus. So, you've got that lotus almost opened. It's the final stage. And inside that is the famed jewel in the heart of the lotus. And if you're very still, that opens up. In the middle of the last of the jhanas, you see Nibbana, the jewel in the heart of the lotus. And you know what that is? Nothing. Emptiness. What Ajahn Chah said, there's nothing there. So sure, Nibbana is inside you, but this so-called original mind, Nibbana, is empty. Nothing there. How could it be any different? If there was something there, you'd have to look what's inside of that something. When there's nothing, then you've got to the end. So that's the jewel in the heart of the lotus, that's what I mean. But it's inside there, you're going to go in and in and in till you get to the famed jewel in the heart of the lotus. Okay? You got one, yes? Okay, Moon. It's going to be a late night tonight. Yeah? Nah, just... because it's hard in the lay life, but some of you, it's amazing these days in the lay life, you may have some rich parents, you've got your house, you're very careful not to get married and caught up in having kids, and you've done that pretty well so far, but be careful, it can happen very easily. And because of that, that, you know, I always remember Ajahn Chah's story. Because Ajahn Chah's story, he had, you know, the girl in the same village or the next village, they fell in love when they were very young. And they were going to get married, they planned their whole life together. And this is Ajahn Chah. And then he got the shock of his life when I think the girl parents came along and said, no, they've arranged a marriage, she's going to marry what was actually Ajahn Chah's best friend. And you can imagine what it's like that, you know, the person you've decided you both love each other, you want to get married, but because your parents decide arranged marriages, no. And worst of all, she was going to marry his best friend, his mate. He was really upset, and that's why I think one of the reasons he became a monk. But afterwards, you know, getting enlightened and stuff, then he thought, wow, thank you, my best friend, you saved me from a lot of misery and trouble. But at the time I couldn't see it. So if you ever get dumped by a girl, you're very, very lucky. It's the most compassionate thing she's done. So well done. So the point is, it's very dangerous. You get sticky, but at least as a monk, you've got a bit more safety. And just as I said, the monk life is more conducive to the attainment of jhanas. Does that answer your question first? Okay, yes. Yeah? Well, there we go. You can't win them all. But you caught me out that time. No, just like horses for courses. So that's sort of the book, Opening the Door of the Heart, is actually for those people who would never leave the home, They never become monks. But sort of the other next book I'm writing is actually just for more for the meditators. You can sort of see beyond. Because a lot of times that when you have these marriage breakdowns, you're going to get married. If you leave that wife, you're going to go and get another one afterwards. So it's just, you're not going to sort of become a monk. So if you're going to live the home life, live it well and solve those problems. If you're going to sort of become a monk, then become a monk, become a nun, stop messing around. Or, you know, you can be like a monk or nun in the world, in the sense that you live alone, you live like a monk or nun, fine. But make your decision and be very clear what you want to do in life.
When one hasn't yet got anywhere close to jhanas, does it seem like a very compassionate desire?
To what?
To get to the point where you're going to leave your partner.
Oh, yeah, I know, but sometimes. What happens is like, even like the Buddha himself, the Bodhisattva, before he became a monk. Now you can see that sometimes that happens. Sometimes it's either an arranged marriage or peer pressure, or when you're very young, you don't know what you're doing. You get married because it's just what people do, that's all. And as many people get married because it's just peer pressure, just what you expected to have done. And sometimes you have babies because that's not because you really want one, it's just because that's what women are supposed to do. And sometimes it's amazing just how strong that peer pressure is. And obviously, that if anyone comes to me and they want to be a monk and they want to ordain, but they have got a family and no one's really looking after their family, they're being irresponsible. I would never allow them to become a monk that way. If they have a family, but you know, they're looked after, everything is fine, fine. So, you know, it's compassionate in the sense that in the long run, it's the happiest thing for everybody. But sometimes, you know, they get married, they have a relationship. They don't run away to become a monk, just they run away to go off with somebody else, and that happens all the time. So at least it's a bit better to often be running away and become a monk. Apparently there's a radio show on recently in Perth, and somebody was listening to it on the way to our monastery, and it was, what was it, about I think people being jilted, and that was actually the whole theme of the talk back. And somebody rang up and they said, yeah, I had a sort of a boyfriend, and he ran away to become a monk at Serpentine. We're not quite sure which monk it was, but it's one of mine. And she was complaining on the talk about later. And Anna Garrica. Oh, you know which one it was? That was that?
I think it's
Amanda. Oh, come on. If that was the case, that girl's got a long memory. Now, let's go to the next question anyway. Which are the four paths of the four fruits in the Supabandhi state? Okay. I think I understand this question. The four paths and the four fruits. Now, you have, on the path to being a stream winner and being a stream winner. The path to being a once returner and being a once returner. The path to being a non-returner and being a non-returner. The path to being an arahat and being an arahat. That's why when you chant in the morning, the Chatari Purisa Pugalani, the Purisa Yugani, the four pairs, the eight types of people. And this is what it means, that the four states of enlightenment split up into eight types of people on the path and getting that. It's very clear in the teachings of the Buddha actually what the path of being a stream winner is. They say there are two types of people on the path of being a stream winner. There's what's called the Sadanusari, the one who's got lots and lots of preponderance of faith. They've got so much faith in the Buddha's teaching, in the path, even though they don't quite understand it, they're just going to follow it. They're just going to do it. They're going to keep the precepts, they're going to practice meditation. They've got faith in non-self, so let's give it a try. And the other ones, the Dhammanusari, they're mostly gone by wisdom. They've actually figured it all out. They have enough experience. Yeah, they've got an understanding through experience of non-self or of suffering. But whatever it is, either their understanding or their faith is enough to make them follow the Eightfold Path. That's the most important thing in their life. So if they're following the Eightfold Path, they will eventually become stream winners. And in the suttas, it says quite clearly that once you're on that path, you have to become a stream winner in this life. If not, sort of now, at least by the very end, at the time of your death. And many people do become stream winners at the time of their death, simply because that's the time when you really see letting go. Everything's falling apart. You can't mistake it. And so that's the first two paths. The path of being a stream winner and achieving stream winning. Now the next paths and fruits are very hard to distinguish, because the path of being a once returner and being a once returner, even being a once returner, is very difficult to distinguish exactly when that actually happens. And so because of that, we always keep saying that once you become a stream winner, that almost is automatically you're on the path of being a once returner. That the achievement of stream winning and of being on a path of being a stream winning is almost like the same. Going back to that simile of the shipwrecked sailors, once you actually see the land, that's a course for you swimming towards the land. You're on the path already. Just seeing it is actually the start of the path. And once you become an anagami, you're standing in the surf, obviously you're going to walk the rest of the way. So there is very lot of confusion between exactly the path and the fruit and the other stages. However, the Abhidharma, which was certainly after the time of the Buddha, not the teaching of the Buddha, started really confusing the issue by saying that what the path means is a few mind moments before the attainment of the anagami or arahat or whatever. And that's really sort of wrong, because it's very clear that for the stream winner, it's many moments before. And sometimes years before you're on the path, and then you finally become a stream winner. So the Abhidharma is there very clearly wrong. And so that it gets a bit sort of confused, the paths and the fruits. It's mostly an Abhidharma category. So instead of being confused by something which came a long time after the Buddha and which is basically wrong, demonstrably wrong, you can actually just follow the four attainments. It's good enough. And maybe just on the path of being a stream winner, that's a very good category to have in your mind. But the rest of the paths and fruits, it was a construction which came a long time, the way it's explained in the Abhidharma, a long time after the time of the Buddha. That make sense okay there? Okay, it's good to know the time scale of these things, otherwise you get confused. What is the program for tomorrow afternoon? Are we going to get a brief introduction of our Dharma friends? Thank you. You've had a brief instruction to your Dharma friend. You have only one. You've got eight Dharma friends. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and your best friend of all, jhanas. So they, may they be your Dharma friends. Otherwise, these people sitting next to you, what are they? Just bunches of five khandhas, that's all. Just bodies which come and go. So, have your real Dharma friends, the peace and the joy in your heart. They're your real friends. So what's the program tomorrow afternoon? Wait and see. Life is exciting when you don't know what's going to happen next. Basically, I don't know. Wait and see until tomorrow. What is Buddhism's stance on vegetarianism? By eating meat, is one breaking the precept of not killing, even though he may not be directly involved in the killing of an animal? By buying, cooking, eating, does that have negative karma? By buying meat, are we not creating the demand, hence involved in the killing process with metta? What happens even if you buy rice? You're involved in the killing of animals. Even if you buy vegetables, you're involved in the killing of animals. If any of you have ever been to a farm or been to the paddy fields, whenever they plough the fields, I saw that so many times. The plough just digs up so many sort of creepy crawlies, most of which get broken by that plough or stomped on by the water buffalo afterwards. And you can see all the birds, they follow the plough and they start picking up either the dead animals or the ones which actually survived and trying to call for safety. So even rice is at the expense of other people's lives. Don't know how many of you drove here. Look on your windscreen and how many insects have splatted on your windscreen. So it's best actually not even to leave your house. And not even, maybe don't even eat anything. So the point is there that the Buddha made it very clear here, sort of the idea is not to actually to be 100% sort of vegetarian, because it's impossible. Even eating rice in that sense is not vegetarian, but we're trying to limit the destruction of life as much as we possibly can. Limit it. So that's actually the answer, basically. Next question. Dear Ajahn, if a person can donate a kidney or an organ to a stranger, not family, not a friend, I know attached, for free, does that indicate that that person has realized non-self? Not really. You're just giving a kidney, not yourself away. You know, one of the most inspiring stories was that monk in Sri Lanka. I love this story because apparently, you know, many monks, they go and give blood. And when you give blood, sometimes they can test your whatever DNA, whatever blood type it is. And you know, he said it was an organ donor. I'm an organ donor too. I've got the card in my bag somewhere. And he got a letter back that there was a person who needed a kidney and they had a perfect match with this monk, but there was a problem. Because the person who needed a kidney was a born-again Christian evangelist who was going around Sri Lanka turning all the Buddhists into being Christians. And so he said, you're a Buddhist monk. Are you going to give your kidney to this person who's converting people from being Buddhist into being Christian? What would you say? Without any hesitation, he said, of course, I don't care what she is. She's a human being, and I will certainly give my kidney. And that really inspired me, because that's actually what letting go is. A person needs it. Doesn't matter who they are. If you need it, I give it. So that was a person who was very close to non-self. And that's very inspiring to do that. Dear illuminated Ajahn, exterminated, please. The Buddha was said to be a bodhisattva in his past life, but not in his last birth. Why was that? What is your definition of a bodhisattva? Mahayana Buddhists feel that Theravadas are not doing enough to help alleviate the sufferings in the world. Oh my goodness. I'm working my butt off for other people in the world. How can I do any more? You should see my schedule. Especially next month, I don't know how many places I'm going to. To help alleviate the sufferings in the world, hospitals, old folks' homes, orphanages are built and run primarily by Mahayana Buddhists. Please comment, please. The Theravada Buddhists through many hospitals. You go to Thailand and there's heaps of hospitals run by the Theravada Buddhists. The thing is, we don't make a big fuss and bother about it. And one of the projects, I never actually, people told me this, it was actually a fascinating project, that, you know, there's enough schools and hospitals and orphanages which were run by Buddhists, or actually, you know, built by Buddhists. But there's this one monk, he went to visit the women's jail in Bangkok to see someone in there to help them with some dharma to ease their problems. And he was disgusted with the state of the prison for women in Bangkok. So what did he do? He raised some money and he sponsored a prison. So it's really a bit of a lateral thinking. He said, well, you know, there's enough hospitals, and monks are always building hospitals, so let's build a prison. So this was a monk who built a prison. He realized that, you know, that ladies are going to go to prison, people, men are going to go to prison anyway, and the government's not going to sort of fork out to not build a nice prison for them. So out of compassion, he sponsored a nice prison. And that's actually, I don't know how many, has any Mahayana monk or nun built a prison? It's interesting, and it was real compassion and wisdom, because it can have a prison there anyway, let's make it a nice one. And no one else was doing that. So that's actually compassion with wisdom as well. So it's the Theravada does all of that and more, but sometimes it's not emphasized. Now, we run a sponsor, the main sort of source of income for this orphanage in Bangladesh. We do a huge amount of tsunami work, all sorts of work, whatever we can do. But, you know, we do, Theravada does its bit. In Theravada countries, there's huge amounts of work done. So it's not really a point that sort of Mahayana Buddhists do all of the charity work. Theravada does as much, if not more. But the idea of a bodhisattva, and, you know, what was actually the Buddha, and it's interesting that when you actually look at the suttas, and you actually see, when did the Buddha use that word bodhisattva? The only time he uses that word was from the time he was in the Tusita realm to the birth in this last life until the time of his enlightenment. And that's when he called himself a bodhisattva. Even when he talks about his previous lives, he never calls himself a bodhisattva. And the thing is that a bodhisattva, in its original meaning, was a person destined to be a Buddha. And the only thing you can actually work out from the use of that word in the original text is that it was only in the Tusita realm did he know that he was absolutely destined to be a Buddha. Before then, it was uncertain. And the reason for this is another very wonderful piece of information in the Gatikara Sutta. Gatikara was this anagami, I mentioned him already, the potter who would never dig the earth, would never sell his pots, would leave them there bartering. You can give some rice if you want to, but you can take a pot without any money if you really want to, because he had to look after his blind parents. That's the only reason he didn't become a monk, because he was actually caring for his family. It was a compassionate thing to do, and accepted that you would look after your family. You wouldn't ordain if the family were without support. That was wrong. So he had a friend called Jyotipala, and Jyotipala was a very proud man. And even though this was in the time of the previous Buddha, Kassapa, even though that Gatikara was a devout Buddhist, an anagami, a disciple of Kassapa the Buddha, his best friend would always be bad-mouthing Kassapa the Buddha. Said he was basically a shaven-headed, lazy, no-good layabout, or words to that effect. He was actually, the words he would use in the Pali was just really derogatory to Kassapa. This was Jyotipala. And Gatikara, this was Gatikara's best friend, and he wanted to somehow, you know, like you may have a best friend, he wanted to get involved in Dharma, learn some meditation. And he used all sorts of tricks, and eventually he managed to trick his best friend Jyotipala to go and at least seeing Kassapa the Buddha. And as soon as Jyotipala, this very arrogant, bad-mouthed Brahmin, actually went to go and see the Kassapa the Buddha, straight away he was smitten, taken by Kassapa the Buddha, became a disciple, became a monk under Kassapa the Buddha. This was Gatikara's best friend, called Jyotipala. And in the end of the sutta, the Buddha said, that was me, I was Jyotipala. And that's the very recent life of Gautama Buddha. And that's reinforced in the Devaputta Sangyutta, where just after the Buddha's enlightenment, one of the devas who came down to congratulate the new Buddha was Gatikara. Because the Anagamis, they go to the Sudawasa, the heavenly realm, they live a long time. So he's still there, and he came down and said, yeah, you know, we were in the same village in the time of Kassapa the Buddha. Now I really come to congratulate you, well done. But at the time, there was no suggestion that that man, Jyotipala, would become a Buddha. In fact, if you look at his conduct, he was alive in the time of a previous Buddha and couldn't even recognize what a Buddha was. So it shows that a person about to be a Buddha, in a life very, very close to his Buddhahood, has got no spiritual qualities much to think about. They can't even recognize a Buddha. They've got no great powers. In fact, they've got immense stupidity. They can't even recognize a Buddha. Now that's description of a bodhisattva, or a person rather, about to become a Buddha in a lifetime which is very close to his final attainment. So a person about to become a Buddha is not got great spiritual qualities. You can't distinguish them from you. Next, if Jyotipala became a monk under Kassapa the Buddha, you'd expect that he would get some sort of attainment, certainly would understand the Dhamma, certainly he would have listened to things like the Four Noble Truths. So when Siddhartha Gautama was under the Bodhi tree in the first watch of the night, what had happened? He remembered his past lives. After getting through the jhanas, the first thing which he did was remember his past life. This was before he was enlightened. Hadn't got the enlightenment experience yet. The jhanas, remembered his past lives. Now that was a very recent past life under Kassapa the Buddha. Surely, I say, he would have remembered his life under a Buddha. And surely when he remembered his life under Buddha, he said with all its details, surely would have remembered what Kassapa taught him. Wouldn't, under the Bodhi tree, Siddhartha Gautama, shortly to become the Buddha, have remembered all those teachings he got from Kassapa, things like the Four Noble Truths? So did the Buddha discover these things for himself, or did he remember them from the time under a previous Buddha? It's obvious to me he was recording these things. Even Siddhartha Gautama needed Parato Gosa, the words of another, to get that final attainment. That's what he got. So he had the jhanas, and he had his memory of his past life under Kassapa the Buddha, with all the Dhamma he heard then, the two together, bam, he became enlightened. That's what the Buddha is. But under what's his name, Kassapa the Buddha, you think he gets something. And it says in one of the commentary to the Anguttara Nikaya, it says an interesting saying. It said that once returners, Sakadagamis, are usually born in the Tusita realm. This is where Sakadagamis are usually reborn. And we know the Buddha was reborn in the Tusita realm before his birth. So was Siddhartha Gautama a once returner in his previous life? It makes a lot of sense. Because otherwise, how could he have said, when he was born, this is my last life? How could he have known that? Unless he was a Sakadagami. And that is basically what I say a Buddha is. It's a once-returner who is born at a time when there's no Dhamma available. There's no Buddhism, there's no Eightfold Path being practiced as such. And when a once returner gets born in that time, then they have to get enlightened. This is their last life. They're a once returner. They get enlightened. And if they get enlightened and they teach, that's called a Buddha. If they get enlightened and don't teach, they're the Pajeka Buddhas, the silent Buddhas. Now that goes against much of Theravada's ideas about Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but that is according to the text, and that makes a lot of sense. And the idea that a bodhisattva, a being even about to be enlightened, has all these powers and is wise and intelligent and compassionate, the story of Jotapala argues completely against that. So you're not enlightened until you're enlightened. To at least a stream winner, then you have some idea what's going on. Until then, sometimes you can't even recognize a Buddha when they're right in your village. It's fascinating. And anyway, even if you are compassionate, if you build a hospital, is that helping? Or is it building a meditation center? More help. Which leads people to the end of suffering. Sometimes people said, why do we give money to temples and meditation centers? We should give it to hospitals and poor people. And then I sort of argue against that. Not because, you know, I want things for myself, but I argue against that. What's the biggest suffering in this world? It's always mental suffering is the biggest suffering. The physical suffering can be hard to bear, but nothing like mental suffering. The trouble is with mental suffering, you can't see it. Physical suffering, a cut, a bruise, a bad leg, you can see it all the time. But mental suffering, you can have a person walking down the street, they look perfectly healthy, and they're about to go and commit suicide. They just simply cannot stand their life any longer. This is one thing which the Buddha pointed out, which I know very well. Mental suffering is far, far more severe than physical suffering. We have many hospitals for the physical suffering. We have few places for mental suffering. And those places where mental suffering is most accurately dealt with is monasteries and retreat centers and Buddhist centers. That's why it is a resource for our society. That's why, you know, it's not just the hospitals. Hospitals just deal with physical suffering. But it's the mental suffering which is the most important to deal with. That's why we have monasteries. That's why we need more teachers, more retreat centers. It's more important than hospitals. Yeah. And then people will be very embarrassed to go there. They can see the point I'm making, and this is actually why that I give my effort to these things instead of raising funds for another hospital. And the other thing is this one experience which I had. One of Ajahn Chah's chief disciples, late disciples, if you've seen that book, I think it's, is it called The Mindful Way? There was one TV documentary done by the BBC of Wat Pa Phong Monastery in Thailand a long time ago. I think it was called The Mindful Way it was called. The BBC came and interviewed Ajahn Chah. And this man was one of the people they interviewed there. And he was a local of Bumwai village. And of course, because I was there for 9 years, I knew him really well. And when I visited him once, he was actually basically on his deathbed. So I went to go and visit him and have a chat with him. And I could chat in sort of the local language, Lao, was talking with him. And no, just chit-chatting about many things. But he was like the local herbalist there. And as he was chit-chatting, he said, you know that years and years ago, we never had a hospital in the area. He said, once the hospital came, he said, that's when people really started getting sick. They were pretty healthy before then. And it was just one of these throwaway lines from this old man who wouldn't lie. And sometimes that made me think, do hospitals create sickness as much as they heal them? It's an open question. Well, I don't know, because sometimes the hospitals create sickness. But sometimes that when they're sick at home, sometimes they don't feel that sick. Sometimes they deal with it themselves. Obviously there are some sicknesses they will get, but other sicknesses maybe they wouldn't get. Fascinating question. I don't know the answer to that, but it really made me think. Maybe he has got a point. Yeah. So anyway. Anyway, I've got some more questions to do, and there's no more time tomorrow. So what role, if any, does the formless meditations play in the enlightenment process? Okay, just remember the opening the lotus? You're getting closer and closer to the jewel inside. And the closer you get, so I gave the simile that those lotus leaves get more and more gossamer. So you can actually see through them. And actually, the closer you are, the more you can actually see through. And when you get to the formless, there's hardly anything left between you and Nibbana. It's just so close. So you're going to be able to probably just see through them without even needing to open them to see there's nothing inside. So that's why that you get one jhana, that's enough, but the second jhana is more obvious. Third jhana, it's just right in front of you. Fourth jhana, can't you missing it? The next, the rupa state, wow, it's just obvious. The closer you get, the more obvious it is. If consciousness is infinite, is it then the channel through which mind can communicate out of the five body senses? No, consciousness isn't infinite. Consciousness just arises and passes away in every moment. It's completely defined by the conditions which give rise to its existence. It's not conscious without being conscious of something. The consciousness is the relationship with the known. The knower has to have a known in order to exist. You can't have a knower without knowing something. Consciousness has to have its object, which is why the Buddha actually said it's conditioned. There's an object, comes in the field of consciousness, there's contact, the mind adverts to it, and then there's the sensory experience. So you can't have consciousness without being conscious of something. This is why in those arupa states, the object of your consciousness is disappearing. Because the object is disappearing, so the consciousness is turning off. You get to that last stage of neither perception nor non-perception. What that means is from this end, you're perceiving. The mind, the consciousness is there, but the object has all just about disappeared. You're on the edge of the disappearance of consciousness. And then it disappears completely. Nibbana, the emptiness. Consciousness has turned off. You can't have consciousness and not have an object of consciousness. It's clearly stated by the Buddha that consciousness is dependent upon nama rupa, the object of consciousness. When nama rupa stops, consciousness stops. If you have consciousness, it's of something, and that something has to be changing. You can never be conscious of the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. No more than you can perceive a sound which is constant for a long time. The consciousness is discriminating. That's why in part it's called vijnana. Jnana means knowing. Vij means like the word for two, like the same as bi cycle. Bi in English, vi in Pali. It means like a duality knowing. And if there's only one thing you know, it disappears. Which is why, when you have the oneness of mind in jhanas, things begin to disappear. Because there's a singleness, and it goes. Understand? So it's consciousness, it's thing is in infinite consciousness. There's a state of the infinity of consciousness, it's just a perception, it's just a way of looking, it's not a truth. So that makes sense. See what happens when your consciousness completely disappears. Where are you left? Dear Ajahn, have you ever come across monks or lay person who have good meditation, i.e. jhana, to have mental diseases or disorders such as Parkinson's, schizophrenia, epilepsy? Or have you ever come across anyone with such disorders to start off with, but were cured as a result of their meditation improving? Is good mind states synonymous with good brain function? Very good. Well, you've got to take Ajahn Chah. He was in a coma. So we didn't have his Parkinson's, schizophrenia, epilepsy. He was comatose. But he still got into jhanas. And we all know the story why that happened, because... You know that story? Because there's quite a few occasions when Ajahn Chah was, you know, in his coma, couldn't speak, had to be looked after by the monks. And as soon as he got into that state, the monks had a meeting. And they said, what should we do with our teacher? And they said, just let him die naturally, because his teaching career is over. Just the body, let it go. And as soon as they said, just, you know, no medical intervention, let him die, within I thought it was a few hours or a day or two, they got a letter from the King of Thailand, no way, keep that guy alive. So on orders from the King of Thailand, they had to look after Ajahn Chah. That's actually why they kept on looking after him, on orders from the king. And the king paid for a male nurse from the local hospital on a roster, 8-hour shift throughout every day, every week, every month, every year of his illness, which was about 9 or 10 years. And there's always about 3 monks around doing other duties for their teacher. So it used to be about 3 or 4 monks plus the male nurse. And it happened several times that the Ajahn Chah stopped breathing, which is what happens when you go into fourth jhana. The breath stops. And it happened one time, there's a new nurse on duty, this male nurse, and Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. And the new nurse freaked out, because he didn't know anything about jhanas, and if you stop breathing, you're going to die. And as I sometimes tell the joke, he knew Ajahn Chah was going to die one day, but he did not want Ajahn Chah to die on his shift. It's very problematical when that happens. So he wanted to get Ajahn Chah breathing again. The monk said, leave him alone, he's just in jhana. I don't believe this. Yes, he is. It says in the suttas, he's done this all the time. It's okay. And the nurse would not accept it, so they came to a compromise. The nurse took a blood sample every few minutes just to make sure the blood was well oxygenated. And I think it was in this state for 3 or 4 hours, and throughout the state, the blood was well oxygenated, but it wasn't breathing at all. The reason is because you're so still, you're not using any oxygen. Or sometimes people say it's actually absorbed through your pores or something. But certainly he wasn't breathing for many, many, many hours. Perfectly okay. And because your blood was well oxygenated, the blood's going to go to the brain anyway, so there's no brain damage, be fine. So the nurse was happy, the monks were happy. We had a nice little bit of information there to know that Ajahn Chah was certainly doing his jhanas, even though he was in a coma. Or was he in a coma? What is a coma anyway? But if you have jhanas getting Parkinson's, one interesting thing, so I think Ajahn Jacko asked Ajahn Chah this question. He said, if an arahat gets bitten by a rabid dog, will the arahat get rabies? And he says, of course he will. It's just the body. The body gets the rabies, but the mind is above it all. So you just get the body functions, but the mind is peaceful. And sometimes people do actually get rid of these diseases through deep meditation, but Parkinson's and schizophrenia, that's an interesting one. I'm not quite sure if the brain is damaged, how much the mind can do. The mind is independent of the brain, so the mind's having a great time, but the body is doing its thing. Make sense? Okay, I'm going to go through these questions. Sorry, this question has got no relation to meditation, but I'm going to ask it anyway, but I may not answer it. Once a 3-year-old came up to me and asked me why a monk has got no hair. How do you tell a kiddo why? And in fact, I don't know why myself. It's a symbol of impermanence, of anicca. Hair today, gone tomorrow. That's an old one. Of shaving the head during ordination, and why does monk need to shave their heads when the Buddha gets to keep his forehead of hair? The Buddha never had a head, but that's just the custom afterwards. The Buddha shaved his head as well. But now people think, no, he didn't need to shave his head because he was somehow special. But the real Buddha, very clear from the suttas there, no one could tell the difference between the Buddha and any other monk. So this is what we mean by hagiography. Once he becomes a Buddha, becomes special, they didn't need to have a wash because no dust would ever actually get to his body at all. Never needed to go to the toilet or anything else. And it's, you know, quite clear. This is just what we make of our sort of heroes. So that's not really true. But the reason why monks actually shave their hair, because it's a symbol of letting go of vanity. You don't have to worry about hairstyles. It's very practical, it's very cool, and it's very sort of easy to do. So less possessions you need. So that's why we shave our head. It's a really neat thing to do. With my hands in Anjali, this is to express my gratitude to you, Ajahn Brahm, for your valuable Dharma teachings and encouragement will help me to have a very peaceful state of mind in the last couple of days. What about the rest of the days? Anyway, Ajahn, your ability to explain deep Dharma in simple language with a sense of humor and wittiness is a unique quality. Ajahn, you practice what you preach, which makes you an ideal role model to these young monks and to us. May I sincerely wish you peace, good health, and long life and ultimate enlightenment. I hope my grandchildren will be able to attend a retreat before that. Thank you, your mum. No, it's just from somebody signing it. It's a nice word of praise. I didn't write it. It's not my handwriting. Then Ajahn. Ah, there are two levels of the Eightfold Path. One for people who have attained jhana and for the rest who are waiting to attain. Actually, because the last factor is jhana anyway, so it can't be two. The last factor of the Eightfold Path, Sama Samadhi, is always, every time, consistently, nothing else, defined as four jhanas. That's what Sama Samadhi is. I know in the Burmese tradition they say, no, you can have Upachara Samadhi, that's the same. That's not according to the Buddhist teachings. It's always, every time. Sama Samadhi is always jhana. Jhana, 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 jhana. Next question here. Dear Ajahn, coming on retreats is like having a taste of freedom. I wish it could last longer. Soon we will have to go back to our prisons of the world called reality. I aspire to leave the world one day and hope the right causes and conditions arise to make this possible. Oh, may it be, may it be. Thank you for your inspiring teachings during this retreat. Okay, you make your world and you make your prisons. Remember what a prison is? Any place you don't want to be. If you want to be here, you're always free. You can be free anywhere. And you can be in prison anywhere. It's up to your attitude, not up to what's outside. Next question. Ajahn, when is your book due to be released? Is it only available in Australia? Thank you. My book will be released sometime in the future. Who knows? The future is uncertain. You may not be here for when the book is released. You may be dead already. Death happens, you know. And as I usually say, that when you count like 40 or 50 people in the room, it means that by next year, about 1.5 of you will be dead. Some of you are already half dead. That counts for the that counts for the 0.5. Who is the other one? Is going to be dead by next year. And as I say, do not look at the old ones. It could be you. So you may not make it to the time I'm about to say, better meditate. And then you won't need my book. Time is running out. Tick tock, tick tock, tick tock. Who knows how many moments you have left. But I will tell you this, you're not going to die before this retreat is finished. So you have another 40,000 seconds to become enlightened, or at least get jhanas, then you will not need my book. But in the meantime, in August. Next question. In meditation, if meditation is all about non-striving, then why does a typical description of right effort read as follows? A monk generates desire for the non-arising of arisen evil, unwholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives, and so on, because it's badly translated. Basically, the translations were done by scholars, not by people who have actually achieved anything. When actually that you're a scholar, you get things like vitaka vichara, becomes thinking. Anyone who gets into a jhana knows that's crazy, crazy description. You can't be thinking within a jhana. But still, it's people say that it's what's applied and, what's the other one? Sustained thought. Ridiculous translation. But nevertheless, you get some of these dodgy translations at first. They're usually okay. But the point is, with the right effort, it's the monk generates, it's not desire, it's called chanda. And chanda means like the approval. It's much more refined than desire. Like, chanda is what you could do if you go into a meeting and you can't attend and you give your proxy, your approval for it. So it's a more refined thing about the desire. You approve this. You know, you say, allow it to be. That is chanda. But sometimes in other circumstances it might mean desire, because you can see it has that whole movement, like approval, acceptance, yeah, this is okay, this is what I'll go for. So when you actually have these different ways of translating these terms, sometimes a slightly different translation lose the whole meaning and you don't really understand it. That's why translations are always very, very difficult. So same with some of Ajahn Chah's books. You know, because I was with Ajahn Chah, I know what he taught. And some of the translations, yeah, Ajahn Chah never said this. And they look for the original Thai, and it's an ambiguous translation, and they've got the wrong one. So that's why I usually love reading the suttas in Pali, because it's not a translation. I can understand what the Pali is, and you get a much closer understanding of the truth. Like the other day, I was talking about Yoni Samanasikara. Instead of actually saying, was it the wise attention, sort of, which has one sort of meaning? Well, what does it actually really mean? You say the work of the mind which goes to the source of things. That's a far more evocative and meaningful description, and that's more accurate to what that word really means. So sometimes it's a translation's fault. And you know this, because if you do try any striving, you generate desire. Some of you have been doing that already. Does that lead to wholesome states? Check it out for yourself. Desire, strive, and what does it lead to? So when you actually understand from experience, the arising of wholesome states comes from letting go. And some of you have done that. And you're surprised. You've just done nothing. You've really made peace. You've let things go. And you get those amazing experiences. And watching the breath is really easy. It gets so peaceful. You get this beautiful bliss. And you don't get angry afterwards. You feel at peace. People who strive usually get very angry. The ones who are just really the tough nuts, are going to go for enlightenment, they get angry afterwards. You watch them. So you can see where unwholesome states come from, where wholesome states come from. So when you understand from experience, you can make a much better translation. Last question. Is that okay? Anyone want to say anything about that? Yes, John. As it's written, you'd have difficulty because you'd have to really think of it. It's Chandang Janati. You develop, I'd say, like approval or acceptance. Waya Mamati is basically that Waya is, or maybe like Guspaya, maybe. Waya Mamati, Paganhati, means that you take hold of. The letting go, if you like. Ganhati means to grasp. Paganhati means like really taking hold of. So you, that letting go thing is you really maintain. Paganhati, why mati? Paganhati, what's the other one? I forget what the other Pali word is. Why mati? Paganhati. Chandang Janati. Now I can't remember the fourth word. So I don't know. Padana could be, yeah. Sorry? No. It is. I think it's Padana. Padahati. Padahati, yeah. It comes from the same word, Padana, Padahati. And again, it's just another word for like really applying yourself. So you apply yourself to letting go. So you're mindful, you really let go properly. That's how I translate it. Yes? Yes.
And
you
could have just gone off to the
jhana. Yeah, we did. We go in jhanas.
But why must he drink more?
Well, it's interesting that it's for an arahat, there's the poems of the arahats, which give you an insight into the mind of the arahat. They said, I don't long for death, but I don't fear life. They're at peace. So basically, they don't give a damn. Dying or living. So, if he lives, he lives. If he's in a coma, he's in a coma. So it's just that peace there. And some people say that maybe carried on just to give other people an opportunity to make good karma by looking after him. That may be the only reason.
So
Make sense?
The other question is, you were saying that the Buddha during his last birth,
yeah,
you mentioned that this was his last birth.
Yeah, that's when he was born.
Search for 6 years.
That's another interesting question. Because usually what happens is that you remember your previous life in the very first years of your life. And it's usually about puberty. You forget your memories of a previous life. These are the spontaneous ones. So that he would remember his previous life when he was born. And no, I'm Sakadagami. This is my last life. But then that'll all get forgotten when he gets to his puberty years. Anagami, you don't get reborn in this world. You get reborn in what's called the pure abode, the Sudarvasa. Many people think that that's probably a corruption of that idea, is where the pure land came from. Because it's, you know, very similar, pure abodes, pure land.
Can you say something about pure land?
No. You're getting late in the day, and you go for a long time with pure land. No, you said only another question. Go on, okay, yes. You only got one question after this, go on.
The chanting the Abhidhamma and the funeral.
Yeah.
So, what is the purpose of chanting the Abhidhamma? Is it for the living or for the deceased?
I think it's for the monks to get more money, I don't know. But the point is that sometimes what they do. Sometimes, because actually, monks sometimes charge to go to funerals, and that's gross. So we, you know, as I tell you, we go there for free. You try, you give a donation, don't give a donation, we still go there. And very often haven't got any donations, just done it for free. And sometimes they chant the Abhidharma. The idea was, the Abhidharma was like the heart of the teachings. Actually, it's, even though I say the Buddha never taught the Abhidharma, there's amazing powerful teachings in there. They're really good stuff, some of them. Not all of them, but some of them are very, very good. So the idea is, it's like a summary of the teaching. The teachings in brief. So there's a dead person, they're about to go, you haven't got much time, so you can't give long talks of question and answer like you do here. Especially no questions, not for dead people. But what you can do, just give a really deep teaching of the Buddha straight away, and hopefully that's going to enlighten them. So this is why they had the idea of Abhidhamma, really deep teachings, let's go for it, the last chance to the dead person. But the point is, they usually chant in Pali, and very few people even that are alive can understand Pali. It becomes this old ancient tradition which we do having no meaning at all. So sometimes you say, what are you doing that for? So a lot of times I don't do that chanting anymore. If it's like a Thai funeral and they demand it, okay, we'll do it for you. But you know, what's the meaning of it? Even the people there don't know the meaning. Even most of the monks who do the chanting don't know what they're chanting, what it means. So, you know, what are you doing it for? So sometimes it's these rituals which accumulate over the years. And because the Asian tradition, you never question your teachers. You just do it. In the Western tradition, you always question. And that's why some of the old baggage of Theravada Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, when it meets the West, there'll be so much questioning that much of that baggage will have to be jettisoned if Buddhism will survive. That's great for Buddhism. So it becomes a bit more pure. Dear Ajahn, is there, we've got a deep question to end off with. Is the unconditional mind similar to the mind of a newborn baby? Is this what state we need to get back to? If you get back to the baby state, you will have more nappies, more crying, and more dummies, pacifiers stuffed into your mouth. That might be a good idea. It might keep you quieter. What a great way for noble silence next retreat. Get 50 pacifiers. Then you won't be able to speak at all. Now, the unconditioned mind. The idea of an unconditioned mind means a mind without causes, which means a mind which has ceased. Condition means it's been brought into being because of causes. That's what condition means. When the causes have vanished, so does the result. So the unconditioned mind means no mind, it's gone. Somehow, trouble is, though, there is one sutta, actually two suttas. One is in Udana, one is in Itiwutika. These are not central parts of the suttas. These are poems meant mostly for edification rather than for strong teaching. Right? Poems are meant to create a mood rather than to be precise. But nevertheless, in those two sort of, you might call them like side streets of the main Dhamma discourses, there you find the saying, the ati, there is, unconditioned, unborn, unmade, unfashioned, called Nibbana. Now the trouble is that when you translate, people put the word the in there. They said there is the unconditioned, there is the unborn, there is the unmade, there is the unfashioned. Otherwise there would be no end or no escape from the born, the made. And straight away that people think that this is a state, Nibbana is a thing, and this is a problem. Now, to understand what I mean by this, I refer you to that great book of philosophy called Alice in Wonderland. In this book, one of my favorite episodes is where, I don't know if I mentioned this already, when Alice is going on a journey, yeah, and the messenger, and through the looking glass, well, it's one of those two, who cares anyway. Through the looking glass, Alice has just arrived at the place of the White King. And the White King said, I'm waiting for my messenger. Did you pass my messenger on the road? Said, no, I saw nobody on the road. You saw nobody at such a great distance? It's as much as my eyes can do to see somebody in this light. Straight away, they were talking about nobody being a person. And when the messenger arrived, the king asked the messenger, did you see anybody on the road? He said, I saw nobody. And they said, I passed nobody on the road. No, he said, did you see anybody? He said, no, I saw nobody. And the king said, yes, this lady saw nobody as well. So that makes a lot of sense, saw the guy. And what was it, did you pass nobody on the road? Did you pass anybody on the road? No, what did he say? He said, did you pass anybody on the road? He said, nobody passed me on the road. And the king was very disgusted and said, you're my messenger, you're supposed to be fast. That means nobody walks faster than you. He said, well, yeah. And he had this whole play of words about the idea of a nobody and a somebody. And the point is that it's so easy to take nobody to be a person's name. To take the unborn as being something which comes into existence. To take the unconditioned as an ultimate reality, and to take Nibbana as the ultimate retirement home. And the point is, if you know Pali grammar, these are called, privative or privative prefixes. The A before a word. It doesn't mean the opposite, it means the absence of that thing. It means the absence of a born. The absence of a condition, the absence of a fashion thing, doesn't mean the opposite. So it's actually just a very faulty translation which has misled someone to think Nibbana is a place and nowhere is a thing. This is the trouble. The unconditioned is nothing. When conditions are taken away, everything falls apart. So it's not the unconditioned mind. A mind which loses conditions vanishes from existence. Subject to conditions all. What is it? Let's say, when conditions arise, things come into being, conditions fade away, everything ceases. Okay, so may you cease. May you uncondition yourself so you disappear and vanish from samsara forevermore. Gone, never to come back again, never to be seen, vanished. Always say the path of enlightenment is like the meteor, which is this bunch of rock or ice which goes round and round our solar system for millions and millions of years, round and round, not once, not twice, but millions of times, just like the being goes around samsara, now being born a human being, now rich, now poor, now an animal, now a deva, now a ghost, round and round, untold lifetimes. You've twirled, orbited around samsara, now in the light spaces, now in the dark spaces. And like a meteor, one day it sort of meets like a planet like the Earth. Like you, after orbiting around samsara for so long, you meet the Dhamma. And what happens when this meteor sort of meets the Earth's atmosphere? As it goes into the Earth's atmosphere, it burns brightly. And you have this beautiful shooting star, just for a few seconds compared to the lifetime of this great meteor. It bursts into brilliance, showing the light to many people who are awestruck, and then it disappears, and it never goes around samsara again. That's like the arahat. After all this traveling around, you meet the Dhamma. And then meeting the Dhamma, you burn, and it's beautiful, because they call jhanas, jayati is the same word to burn. Brilliant and bright, the brilliant mind, flashing, luminous, on its last few seconds, until it disappears from the orbit of samsara forever. The shooting star, which is the enlightened one. What a lovely way to finish off this talk. Now, come on, let's try again. Sadhu! Sadhu! Okay, there we go. So, thank you for those deep questions. Now, for those of you lazy ones who want to travel around samsara for many, many, many lifetimes, go to bed. For those of you who want to get your money's worth, who knows, this might be your life, your time. But if you really think that you're not going to make it sitting down here, then try one last time Ananda's method for life. Go and have a sleep. Okay, it's a long talk, so go and have a rest. See you in the morning. Remember, the morning is the best time, as long as you're up, that is.